Okay, good morning. And this is Bio 231, and it's Monday, October 13th. And I think some of you might even have a practicum on muscles this week. Some of you. Maybe not today. I don't think it's today, but maybe starting Thursday, Wednesday maybe? I'm not sure. You'll have to check. All right, so don't forget to help you get ready for the next test, which is coming up. I don't know the date. But it's going to be the date that's published in your syllabus. Don't forget, there's an SI today, 12:30 to 2, in LLRC 116. So I would make that one rather than walking home in the wind. So I would go to that SI session. Also, I sent you an email that has a website that I like a lot that shows a bunch of different muscles, and it's organized on the principle of antagonism. And this kind of just underscores the importance of antagonism in terms of control systems in general. And this is a real handy sheet for you to look at. So I don't know if any of you have checked this website, but it is webanatomy.net/anatomy/muscle_actions. And what this does also for you is not only just show you what... Okay, hold on you guys, because I can't yell. I'll lose my voice. If you click on a muscle, it will isolate the muscle for you. So it won't show you the action like I was showing you in Get Body Smart, but at least it will show you the origin and insertion, and at least in your mind, you can see what the motion is going to be like. All right, so here's the platysma. This I don't think is on your list anymore in lab, but you can see the origin, the skin over the lower neck and upper lateral crest over here. The insertion is the inferior border and skin of the mandible. So when this muscle shortens, of course, it's going to what? Depress the mandible. Or it can even flex your neck to some degree. The shaving muscle. Yeah, you want to put a little tone in that muscle when you start scraping a razor blade over your neck. That's for sure. Okay. All right, so I find this pretty easy, and the way that I learn muscles, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, is that unless you're really good at memorizing, I like to understand what's going on, and it's a lot easier for me to understand these muscles if I know antagonistic motions. Right? For some reason, it makes it a whole lot easier for me to remember and memorize these muscles. And what's a good way for you to understand antagonistic motion or synergistic motion of different muscles? What's a nice key that you should have in your mind? For instance, if we say sternocleidomastoid, which is in the anterior neck, how are you going to figure out what an antagonistic muscle to the sternocleidomastoid is? Go to the opposite body compartment and then just kind of run through a list of muscles that you have in your mind about muscles that are in the posterior neck, and that's going to be the antagonistic muscle, right? Or the anterior arm. What are muscles that are going to be antagonistic to the anterior arm? Posterior arm, right? And then you kind of know what muscles are there. So that's actually the easy way to do this. So I think if you look over these this website a couple times, and this will help you fill in your worksheet for lab as well. Okay, so for instance, triceps, brachii, what do you got? Oh, look at this nice diagram right here that shows that. So I would spend some time looking at this website. Okay. All right, so does anybody have any questions? I'm still working on trying to get those figures of the neuromuscular junction for you and a motor unit. I don't have those just yet, but nonetheless, you should start working on those because those are exam figures for the next exam. Okay, and what is that? I think that's 10.9 and 10.10, figures 10.9 and 10.10. All right, so we're going to move on to nervous system today. And so first, just a nice overview of the nervous system. The basic divisions of the nervous system, okay, or something about the nervous system in general, is that it's the master control and communication center of the body. And the nervous system can process information very quickly, and it can send information very quickly. There are a number of information transmission systems in your body, namely, like the endocrine system. The endocrine system secretes a hormone that goes into the blood, and then the blood carries it all over the body, and that's relatively slow. But the nice thing about the nervous system is that it's relatively fast. Okay, so an overview of the nervous system is that we have to, in order for your body to communicate with the environment, there's got to be a receptor someplace in your body for that modality of energy. So in order for you to see light, for instance, what do you have to have? You have to have photoreceptors, okay? You can't have a pressure receptor or a temperature receptor. They don't respond to light, so you need a photoreceptor for light. So the first thing is a sensory receptor, and then that sensory receptor is going to send an electrical impulse toward the brain. And we call these sensory fibers. Another name for a sensory fiber will be an afferent fiber. So afferent and sensory are exactly the same kind of thing. And these always have a one-way direction from your periphery into the central nervous system. All right, then they enter the central nervous system, like your spinal cord or brain, and they synapse on another neuron. These neurons in the central nervous system we call association neurons or interneurons. These are completely found within the central nervous system. They process, they integrate, they make decisions, and they share those decisions that they make with your peripheral body. So they send signals out other neurons to your periphery. So that's the next component. So the way that electrical impulses leave the central nervous system and get to the periphery are with motor neurons. And another name for a motor neuron is an efferent neuron. So efferent and motor are exactly the same terminology. And as you should see right here, that a efferent neuron is always taking information from the CNS, which is central nervous system, to the periphery someplace, where it's going to have some effect on your body. So that's why we call that the efferent system. And we can have a number of effectors. In this particular example, right, this is kind of what you're studying right now for lab, what is the effector going to be? We see like the gastrocnemius or soleus or something, and the general way that we would think of this is skeletal muscle. So skeletal muscle is one kind of effector that is going to be stimulated with a efferent fiber or a motor fiber. There can be other kinds of effectors. All right. So let me just say something about effectors in general. Just like there are many different kinds of sensors, there are different kinds of effectors. And we can group these effectors into two general categories. One category that you have control over, that you have voluntary control over. So what kind of effector would you have voluntary control over that you can cause it to become excited or not? And that's skeletal muscle, right? And that's the only thing you have control over in your body. The other kinds of effectors that you have in your body are cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. Those are the other kinds of effectors. And all of those you don't have any control over whatsoever. All right, so this is a nice just generalized slide of how information is processed. And here is an overview of what the nervous system looks like anatomically. So the first diagram was really more of a functional diagram. This is a nice structural diagram. And you can see the brain and the spinal cord right here that makes up the central nervous system. And in the red, right, that's red, those are all your peripheral nerves. So they're outside the brain and spinal cord. So in the peripheral nervous system, I'll come back to that in a little bit. Okay, so in the nervous system, the way that it communicates with the environment is that there's got to be a sensory input, and it's picked up by some kind of receptor, and then the afferent neuron takes it to the central nervous system where it's integrated, that information is processed, and some decisions then are made, and the decisions are carried out by the motor output that from the central nervous system to the periphery. All right, so the basic structural divisions of the nervous system are the central nervous system and peripheral. The central is brain and spinal cord, and the peripheral are what? Everything else outside the brain and spinal cord. Okay, so I don't think you have this. Oh, you do have it labeled in your notes. Okay, so you don't really have to label this, but don't forget the nervous system divisions are what? The two main ones are central nervous system and peripheral. And central is made up of the brain and spinal cord. The peripheral nervous system, let's break down into two divisions as well. Well, there is the sensory. What's another name for sensory?
Afferent.
Yeah. Afferent is really the correct way of saying it, but in lecture I just say afferent so that you don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I mispronounce it a little bit. So it's really afferent. But afferent and efferent sound very similar. So I mispronounce it just slightly so it's really clear in lecture. But nonetheless, afferent and sensory are exactly the same. Which is what? Which what does that mean? Which way are signals moving? From the periphery into the CNS. All right. And then the other division would be the opposite direction. From the central nervous system to the periphery, and we call that motor or, efferent. All right. Furthermore, we can break down the motor division of the nervous system. And as a matter of fact, as we look at everything in the nervous system over the next week and a half or so, you might just want to think about this diagram because it's going to relate to everything that we talk about in the next week or 2 weeks. Okay? So the motor division can be broken down into somatic nervous system versus autonomic. And autonomic is just a fancy word for automatic. Right? So autonomic means the nervous system that you don't have to control because it takes care of itself. And it takes care of all the things that it is innervating for you without your conscious control. As opposed to somatic. Somatic just means that there are nerves that are going to effectors that you do have control over. So it's voluntary control. So what kind of effector, again, do you have voluntary control over? Skeletal muscle, right? Okay. So somatic and voluntary in this context really are synonymous. They are the same. And autonomic and visceral are pretty much synonymous in this context as well. Okay. Furthermore, we can break the autonomic nervous system down into two divisions, which we can see right here. All right, the sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system. And this is where we're going to employ our understanding of antagonism once again. And this is very important because the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system are antagonistic to each other. So that if the sympathetic nervous system is stimulatory on an organ, guess what the parasympathetic nervous system is on that same organ? It's going to be inhibitory, right? Stimulatory and inhibitory. So most organs have both stimulatory and inhibitory impulses going to it. So that might seem a little funny or that they kind of contradict each other, but what's the beauty of an antagonistic system? Yeah, it gives you, should always just say, precise control as well as balance. That's really, really important. All right, so for instance, your car, you would never think of driving it unless it had what? A gas pedal and a brake. And that gives you precise control and balance of that automobile. So the same thing for your whole body. It's got sympathetic and a parasympathetic that are antagonistic to each other, and these go to viscera, deep organs in your body, which includes smooth muscle, muscles of the digestive tract, reproductive tract, respiratory tract, blood vessels, right, to cardiac muscle, because you don't have to think about what your heart rate is on a minute-to-minute or ever, actually, right? If you start exercising, what is your heart automatically going to start doing?
Increasing.
It's going to start increasing cardiac output. Force of contraction will increase. Your heart rate will increase, and that will supply your body with blood, the necessary blood that it needs, as well as glands. Okay. So, for instance, like a salivary gland. We could compare a salivary gland and cardiac muscle. Say, for instance, you're an athlete and you're getting ready to, say, run a race or something. And even though you're not exercising, you know that race is coming up in just a minute or 30 seconds. You know, the guy is there with a gun ready to pull the trigger to start the race. Guess what your heart rate is? Is it nice and slow or is it already speeding up even though you're not? Yeah, because your mind can anticipate and get ready for that physical activity. And same thing. Right? You don't have to have food in your mouth for salivary glands to start secreting. Right? You can just think of food. Okay. Okay, so that's anticipation. Sometimes we call that feed forward feedback. Okay. So that's an important organization of the nervous system. So here is a diagram that's in your book, maybe a little bit more complicated, but not too complicated. Here's the peripheral nervous system. It's broken down into what? Sensory and motor. And we have some somatic senses. And these somatic senses are on the surface of your body, all right, as opposed to visceral senses, which are deep inside your body. And we have some special senses that we're going to look at after we get done with the nervous system. Okay, and I'll tell you about these a little bit later when we get into that chapter. And for motor, we've got somatic versus visceral or autonomic. All right, so somatic, again, just goes to all skeletal muscle, and visceral goes to those things that we just talked about, to smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and to glands. Okay, so that's just a nice organization of the nervous system. All right, let's see what I wanted to talk about next. Okay, nervous tissue. Okay, so nervous tissue. Let me see if I can change something here. That's a lot helpful to me. Okay, so again, how many different kinds of tissues are in the body? How many different kinds of tissues are there? The most general kind? Yeah, there's four. What are those four kinds of tissues again? It's always good if you can have this nice organization in your mind. You've got, somebody say something out really loud and I say good. Cardiac? That's not a general kind. That's a little special. Okay. What's the first one that we looked at? It covers surfaces. Epithelium, that's one. There's another kind. Connective tissue. And then somebody said a third one, which is muscle, which is just what we got done with. All right, and what's the fourth one? Nervous tissue, and that's what we're talking about today. That's what we're starting with today. And don't forget, with muscle, you got three subtypes. You got skeletal, cardiac, and smooth. All right, so just because nervous tissue is a special kind of tissue all by itself, there are some subclasses that we're going to be interested in. And one of the subclasses is what we call a neuron, and another class are what we call neuroglia. Neurons are the kinds of nervous system cells that conduct electrical impulses, and neuroglia don't carry electrical information. All right, so the human body contains billions of non-dividing neurons or nerve cells, and these are the kind that carry electrical impulses. And most generally speaking, there are three parts to every neuron. There's the cell body, there are axons, and there are dendrites. So let's take a look at what these things look like. So here is a funny looking cell. We haven't really looked at a cell like this before. We've looked at osteocytes and fibroblasts and red blood cells and things like this. But look at all the processes coming off of this cell, all of these projections. And this just allowed neurons to carry electrical impulses very long distances, but also interact with each other electrically. So this part of the cell right here is what we call the cell body. Sometimes we call it the soma, S-O-M-A. And soma just means cell body. Inside the cell body, we've got the nucleus that controls all the metabolic activity of the cell. It's got machinery for making a bunch of proteins, which we call Nissl bodies right here. It's got mitochondria. So if it's making a bunch of proteins, there's a lot of... What kind of organelle inside the soma? What kind of organelle makes proteins? That's from like the first test. That was a couple of months ago already. That is rough endoplasmic reticulum. Okay. okay. And then these small processes right here coming off the cell body, and they are numerous in this example right here, we call these dendrites. And then there is usually one long process coming off the cell body, and this is what we call an axon. So these are the three main regions, the cell body, the dendrites, and an axon. And these have functional significance on this particular kind of neuron. This is what we call a multipolar neuron because it has many, many dendrites and one long axon. Information is always passed from a dendrite to the cell body and then to an axon and then down the axon to an axon terminus or the axonal terminals right here. And that electrical information is what we call an impulse, an electrical impulse. And that's a one-way street. So it only goes dendrite, cell body, axon, and then down an axon. It doesn't ever go the reverse direction. And sooner or later, you'll see why. You'll get maybe a little feel for that in this class. All right, so the receiving part of this neuron right here are the dendrites and the cell body. Receive information. They have special kind of receptors. And then that information is transmitted down the axon. So the axon is actually the sending part of a neuron. So a neuron has got the receiving part and the sending part. What are the two parts of a neuron that are the receiving parts? The cell body and the dendrite. That's right. Inherently different. Different kinds of membrane proteins in the cell body and dendrites compared to proteins that are in the membranes of the axon right here. Okay. We see something else on this slide as well. Along the axon, we see like a little string of pearls right here. So that shows us the second kind of cell that makes up the nervous system, and that are the neuroglia cells. These are support cells. And so here is one support cell. Here is another one, and another one, and another one. And you can see that they're what? Much smaller than this neuron right here. These cells that look kind of whitish in this diagram are called Schwann cells. And they're wrapping around the axon, and the Schwann cell produces a chemical called myelin, and myelin is a lipid. And lipids are electrical insulators. Electrical currents don't like to go through lipids. All right, so these Schwann cells act as electrical insulation wrapping around this axon right here. So if you plug in your toaster, for instance, at home, you have to worry about getting electrocuted. No, why is that? Yeah, because there's insulation around the wires that don't allow the electricity to hop out of the wires that are going to your toaster or iron or whatever you're using, right? And so the function of these Schwann cells around this axon are sort of similar. They don't allow electrical energy leave the axon. So they act like insulation. And this neurolemma is just the outer sheath of this Schwann cell that contains the cytoplasm. Okay, so don't forget, this electrical impulse always goes dendrite, cell body, down this axon in that direction right there. When we look underneath a microscope, this is what a multipolar neuron really looks like. So here is the cell body with the nucleus. Here are a bunch of dendrites, and then the axon is moving down in this direction. All right, and all of these other little cells, all right, are neuroglia cells, or the nuclei of neuroglia cells that are supporting the function of this neuron right here. Here we see two multipolar neurons that are connecting up with each other. All right, so here we see dendrites, cell body, and axon. And what does this arrow here signify? It's the direction of the nerve impulse, right? It's going to move down this axon. And then there is a junction between these two nerve cells right here, and this is a synapse. And I think I told you there are basically two kinds of synapses in the body. There's chemical synapses and electrical synapses. A synapse between these two neurons, these two multipolar neurons, is a chemical synapse. So the information being transmitted by this first neuron is in the form of an electrical signal, and it moves across the synapse. There's a little gap right here, and I can see the gap better in the illustration down below these neurons. This is the synapse. That information gets converted into a chemical signal, which then goes to a dendrite or the cell body of the second cell, which causes a second electrical signal to develop on the second cell, which then goes down the axon. So information always goes in a one-way direction. So don't forget, information is transmitted as an electrical signal, then a chemical signal through the synapse, which then gets converted into another electrical signal in the second neuron. And since this is a synapse right here, the cell on the left is what we call the presynaptic cell, because it comes before the synapse. The cell on the right over here is what we call the postsynaptic cell, because it's after the synapse. And furthermore, we're going to talk about the membranes of these cells. So the membrane at the axon terminus right here is what we call the presynaptic membrane. And the membrane over here on the cell body or these dendrites are what we call the postsynaptic membrane. They're going to have different components. Okay, and this slide right here shows that there can be different kinds of synapses between neurons. All depends on the architecture of our nervous system. So here is an axon of a presynaptic cell synapsing on the cell body of the postsynaptic cell. These synapses, because they occur right on the cell body, we call these axosomatic synapses. Axo because why? This is an axon right here. And somatic because, what is this? This is the cell body. And what's another name for a cell body? That would be the soma. So these would be axosomatic synapses. There can be synapses on a dendrite. So here's a dendrite. Here's an axon from the presynaptic cell. So these kinds of synapses are what we call axodendritic synapses. And furthermore, there can even be a couple synapses, right? When here is an axon of the presynaptic cell actually synapsing on the proximal part of an axon of the postsynaptic cell. And so this one right here is a special kind of synapse. These are what we call axonic, because where's the synapse located? It's between two axons, right? So axoaxonic, as opposed to axosomatic and axodendritic. So again, just by knowing nomenclature, that makes it really handy. We know where these synapses are. Okay. All right, so there are some functional characteristics of neurons. They have the ability to conduct electrical impulses. All right. They live an extremely long time throughout your whole lifetime, if we're careful with them. They don't divide, so that when you lose a neuron, then, of course, you just are missing that functional ability that neuron was providing for you. So that's why brain injuries are so bad and spinal cord injuries are so devastating, because when those neurons get damaged, they don't regenerate, and so spinal cords don't regenerate. They don't, and you just lose that function. So when you get paralyzed because of a spinal cord injury, then of course you're paralyzed for the rest of your life. And also, neurons exhibit a very high metabolic rate. So, yeah.
I have
That's beautiful. So then there's probably a way that signals were able to take some kind of alternate route to get to that effector organ. Okay, so unless the injury was in the peripheral nervous system, sometimes peripheral nerves can regenerate, but nerves in the central nervous system don't. So if it was an injury, say, where they lost motion of their hand, control of their hand, but the injury was in the arm someplace, all right, then they might be able to regenerate control of the hand again. But if it was a spinal cord injury, then they won't be able to regenerate motion again in the hand. Belly button down, so this sounds like a spinal cord injury. Okay. I don't know how to explain that, but I'm sure everybody's really interested to know what's going on in that particular circumstance. Okay, so high metabolic rate, that means that neurons need a lot of energy because they're transmitting electrical information all over the place. So what's the energy molecule in your body? ATP. Where does ATP come from? Or most of the ATP. How is ATP made in your body? By mitochondria. That's right. And mitochondria need a metabolite in order to make ATP. They need a number of them. They need a fuel molecule like glucose, for instance, or fatty acids. Mitochondria can use fatty acids. But they need another molecule. And it's the molecule, it's the reason why we inhale all the time. What's that molecule? It is oxygen. So mitochondria need oxygen in order to make ATP from glucose. All right, and because the brain is so highly metabolic, it's the most sensitive to deprivations in oxygen. And I can't recall at all if I mentioned this in this class at all. But for instance, if oxygen is cut off to the brain, which is made up of neurons, how long can you maintain consciousness? Okay. Maybe I haven't mentioned that in this class yet. Okay. For instance, if your heart stops beating, blood doesn't go to the brain, so oxygen is not being delivered to the brain, you have about 3 seconds of consciousness. Okay, and your brain runs out of ATP and you lose consciousness. So that's what I mean by high metabolic rate right here. Those mitochondria have to be making ATP, what, every second in order for your brain to function properly. And then, this kind of drives home the point as well, if blood flow doesn't get reestablished to the brain, right, if somebody isn't giving you CPR or your heart doesn't start up again right away, your brain is using up ATP and it's going to die. After what period of time do the brain cells actually die because their requirement of ATP is so high? Okay, it's 3 minutes. Yeah, you're right when you say 3 to 4. There's a little variability right there. So 3 seconds and you deplete so much ATP, you can't maintain consciousness after, that was, what did I say? Oops, I meant to say 3 seconds. After 3 seconds, you lose consciousness, and then after 3 minutes, the brain actually dies because it doesn't have ATP. And what happens when something dies, when a cell dies? What does that mean? It's dead. It can't come back to life again, right? So, I mean, if it's just in this suspended animation, like after 3 seconds and you lose consciousness, you only have 3 minutes to reestablish blood flow because those brain cells are just going to, what, irreversibly change. They won't ever come back to life. Okay. So that's real important. So there's a couple other organs in your body that have a similar kind of metabolic rate. Could anybody guess what other organs you might have? Your heart, because it's always pumping, right? Heart can't take a break. Skeletal muscle can take a break. It can go for a pretty long period of time without blood flow. And also the kidneys are highly metabolic. They require a lot of energy constantly as well. Okay. All right, so neurons receive stimuli, transmit their electrical signals, and those electrical signals are what we call action potentials. All right, so it's best to think that information is transmitted as an action potential, and it travels in a one-way direction. The stimulus will stimulate a dendrite, that action potential will flow into the cell body, and then into an axon. All right, so let's classify neurons. There are some structural differences between neurons. Multipolar is what we're looking at first, that had those many dendrites. Let's see if I have a nice picture of some of these. So this is a nice multipolar neuron right here. Okay, so here is a nice multipolar neuron, many dendrites, a cell body, and one long axon going someplace. And where we find these kinds of multipolar neurons are in an efferent fiber leaving the central nervous system. So the dendrites and cell body are in the spinal cord, and then the axon leaves the spinal cord and it goes to the periphery someplace. So this is a nice multipolar neuron or a motor neuron. A bipolar neuron has a cell body, but you can see it has what? 2 prominent processes here. They both kind of look like axons, but one end will be dendrites on one process, and this other process is going to have an axon terminal. And we're going to find out what the difference is between an axon terminal and a dendrite is in just a little bit. And right between this dendritic process and this axonal process right here is the cell body. We don't have many of these kinds of neurons in our body, but they're always associated with some kind of special sense organ, like vision and hearing and olfaction. Ooh, what does olfaction mean? Olfaction is the sense of smell, right? The sense of smell. All right, so you have most neurons in your body probably are motor neurons, And then the third kind of neuron right here is what we call a unipolar, or maybe sometimes called a pseudo-unipolar neuron. Here's a cell body. There's a short single process, and then it bifurcates into a peripheral process over here, which means that this neuron is going to send this long fiber out to your periphery someplace, maybe out to your skin, where there's going to be a receptor for vibration or touch or pain. So here are the receptor endings in your skin, and it sends electrical impulses toward the central nervous system. The cell body is located at the entrance to the central nervous system. And if we look at a cross-section of the spinal cord, here is the cell body of this unipolar neuron, okay, at the entrance to the spinal cord. And then this is what we call the central process. Why do you think we call this the central process? This one right here. Because where is it going? Into the central nervous system. All right, so signals always start in the periphery, all right, and end up in the central nervous system. So this right here is, this unipolar neuron is always going to be a sensory neuron, a sensory neuron. So you're going to have to be able to identify these neurons on the test as being what, multipolar, bipolar, unipolar. And I've got a flash quiz because we're going to look at a bunch of different neurons and neuroglia too. I don't know if we'll get to that today, but maybe next time. Oh, that reminds me also, next time I have an evaluation. So one of my supervisors is going to come in and rank me as a teacher, and you might have to fill out a form. I'm not sure. It's either next time or Monday, huh?
I remember going through this one last weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a Scantron. And you get to say, is a teacher prepared? Yes, no, blah, blah, blah. Can you understand them? Yes, no. Does he assign pertinent assignments, that kind of stuff? And then there's always a place at the bottom, and this is actually the most helpful, where you can write a comment in, okay? So those are really helpful. You have to bubble in probably 10 or 15 questions, but comments are really helpful. So think about what you would like to say. And I don't get any of the feedback until after the semester's over. So I can't make the class any better for you, unfortunately, but I suppose that's best. I think they do that so that if you say a lot of bad things about a teacher to help them improve, all right, if you're very critical, they can't exert any retribution against you. So I won't get your comments till after the semester's over. So if you've got some harsh critical comments, be sure to put them down, okay? Because it won't affect your grade one way or the other. Okay. So, multipolar, motor neuron, bipolar, sensory, especially for what? Some special senses like vision and olfaction. And then the unipolar, this is a typical sensory neuron. Okay. These unipolar neurons are very, very long because, for instance, here is the skin that goes all the way to your spinal cord. These bipolar neurons, they kind of look like it's the same length right here, but these are very short. They're, you know, a million times smaller or thousands of times smaller than these unipolar neurons. They're very, very, very small, okay, because they're completely contained, for instance, within one little tiny layer of the eye. All right, so these are some types of neurons. These are three types of neurons that you have to be aware of. All right, the second kind of nervous system cell are what we call neuroglia. These don't carry electrical signals or electrical impulses. And for a really long time, people were not interested in these because they didn't carry electrical impulses. They just thought that they performed some kind of passive role. And now, physicians and scientists are extremely interested in these nervous system cells, almost more so than neurons, because they maintain the health of neurons, and they also tell neurons how to connect up with each other. And so it's not just important that you have neurons in your body, but it's probably even more important that they get connected up to each other in just the right way, and that's what provides for intelligence and your ability to interact with your environment. The network is very, very important. Okay, so neuroglia are these kinds of cells. Okay, they're non-neuron supporting cells, so they act to support, protect, nourish, and insulate neurons. So we have four kinds of cells in the central nervous system. right? Then collectively we call these neuroglia. Go ahead, say that out loud.
Neuroglia.
You probably don't have to write it out on a practicum or anything, but you never know. Okay. So the four kinds of cells that are neuroglia in the central nervous system are called astrocytes, microglia, ependymal, and oligodendrocytes. These are the four kinds, and we're going to go over what they look like. You'll get it down pretty fast, I'm sure. And in the peripheral nervous system, we have Schwann cells. We talked about those already a little bit. And some satellite cells. So I think, well, let's see what the next picture is over here. Oh, here's, well, this is a really good picture that shows the different kinds of neurons. Let's just look at this real quick. All right, so here is a cell body with a bunch of dendrites on it with one long axonal process. This would be an example of a multipolar neuron, and this is a motor neuron or an efferent neuron, or you can say efferent motor neuron. It's redundant, but that's okay. And here is a nice sensory neuron. And can you identify this kind of neuron? What is it, blue right here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is a nice unipolar, because here is what? A short process coming down, and then it bifurcates. Right, if it was bipolar, it wouldn't have this short little process sticking out right here. All right, and here is a nice representation of the spinal cord. And you know what? As you first start to learn these, it is a little bit confusing. Make sure this is bipolar and this is unipolar. Unipolar because of what? That short little stub right there. Okay. Okay, so this actually shows us a nice response loop where you have a stimulus being picked up by some kind of receptor or receptor endings. Here's an afferent neuron bringing signals into the central nervous system. Here is that association neuron or an interneuron. And interneurons or association neurons are always multipolar in structure as well, just like the motor neuron is a multipolar one. So this unipolar neuron, you can see exists partly in the peripheral nervous system and partly in the central nervous system. This motor neuron, you can see exists partly in the central nervous system and partly in the peripheral nervous system. But there's, of these three neurons that we see, there's only one that is completely found only in the central nervous system. Which one is that? That is the interneuron right here. There's no part of it that's ever found in the peripheral nervous system. It's completely contained in the central nervous system. Okay, and we're going to go over this again, probably, but I'll mention it right now. So you see, here's the spinal cord, and there are two ways to either enter or leave the spinal cord. This part of the spinal cord right here is the anterior side. There's another term for anterior, and that's called ventral. Ventral and anterior are the same. We use these terms interchangeably. So if this is the anterior side, what part is this over here? This is the posterior side, and there's another name for posterior, and that is dorsal. Right? So here is dorsal, here is ventral, and these passageways, either entering or leaving the spinal cord, are what we call roots. So each side of the spinal cord has two roots. So this one right here, guess which root this is? This is the, named after the side of the spinal cord, so this is the ventral root, and this is the dorsal root. And what we see with these roots right here is that the way information moves through the roots is completely defined, and it can only happen in one direction. So what I mean by that is that this dorsal root right here is purely for sensory information. Information enters the spinal cord or the central nervous system via this dorsal root. It can never enter the ventral root because the ventral root is purely for what? Efferent signals or signals, motor signals leaving the spinal cord. Yeah, so here we got these two roots, the ventral root here and the dorsal root. Furthermore, you know that this pseudo-unipolar neuron is the sensory one, right? And there's a little bump on, what root is this again?
Dorsal root.
The dorsal root. This right here is going to be an accumulation of thousands, maybe tens of thousands of pseudo-unipolar neurons. So it's forming a little bump right here. And in the peripheral nervous system, wherever there is an aggregation or an accumulation of nerve cell bodies, we call that a ganglion. And so there are just thousands of nerve cell bodies in this location outside the central nervous system, so we call this a ganglia. And because it's on the dorsal root, we call this the dorsal root ganglion. All right, so this is the dorsal root ganglion. We don't see a ganglion at all on the ventral root, because where's the cell body for this efferent fiber? It is inside the spinal cord, right? So a ganglion has to be outside the central nervous system. Okay, well, here are those cells that I promised we would look at. These are all neuroglia cells. And in particular, these neuroglia cells we find inside the central nervous system, not in the peripheral nervous system. And there are four kinds: the astrocyte, the microglia, the ependymal, and oligodendrocyte. So automatically you're just going to know these are in the central nervous system. The astrocyte right here, you can see, has many different processes that are going in different places, but these processes don't carry electrical information like the processes on a neuron. Okay. Some of the processes you can see are connecting up with the neuron. So the neuron right here is that yellow or gold color. So here is a nice long axon of this neuron going someplace. But it connects to this astrocyte. And the astrocyte, so here's the cell body of an astrocyte. Then there's another process of this same astrocyte that is connecting up with a blood vessel right here. And this blood vessel is actually a nice capillary, and I can see another capillary right here. So this astrocyte actually performs a number of important functions. So things that this neuron needs, like for instance it needs glucose in order to make ATP, are absorbed by the astrocyte out of the blood and then actively transported through these processes directly into the neuron. So that is feeding the neuron. And of course, neurons need glucose to make ATP. Do they need a lot of glucose or just a little bit? What's their metabolic rate? What's the metabolic rate of a neuron? It's high. They need a lot of glucose. So here is a special passageway for glucose to be transported directly to that neuron because it's hungry all the time, right? Okay. Another function that the astrocyte, so not just glucose, but other kinds of compounds that neurons need are transported by astrocytes. But you can see that this astrocyte is, what, forming a nice sheath around this blood vessel right here. And that is also providing a protective function of the brain. So there are many compounds that we have in our diet that are poisonous, that are very toxic. And if they were to get into our brain, our central nervous system, that would intoxicate us or decrease our brain function. So there is a special barrier that prevents many things from entering the brain, and we call that the blood-brain barrier. And the blood-brain barrier is made up of these astrocytes, these foot processes that surround the capillary. So that prevents many harmful substances that's in our blood that really wouldn't affect muscles, for instance, right? But if they were to get into the brain, would render the brain ineffective or produce unconsciousness. Like drugs and alcohol. The alcohol, unfortunately or fortunately, can get across the blood-brain barrier, but there are many drugs that cannot. And that's a problem for certain pharmaceutical companies because they might have a really nice, for instance, antibiotic. So if somebody gets meningitis, an infection of the brain, we would like to give them an antibiotic that gets absorbed and placed into the bloodstream, right? But that drug is then prevented from getting into the brain because of the blood-brain barrier. So then what the pharmaceutical company has to do is figure out a way to design that drug to put some kind of functional group on it that will then, that can figure out a way to get through the blood-brain barrier and actually get to the brain. So we have to be really concerned about this all the time. All right, that's the job of the astrocyte. Another thing about this astrocyte right here, and this is really actually a fascinating part of the job of an astrocyte, is that, remember when we talked about bones? If you exercise a bone, what happens to it?
Stronger.
It gets bigger and stronger. If you exercise a muscle, what happens to it? It gets bigger and stronger, right? So you're familiar with remodeling your body with exercise muscles, but for bone, it's the same thing. How long do you have your skeleton for? Yeah, 5 years, right? And then it's completely rebuilt. Well, the nervous system, the cells don't rebuild themselves. They're the same cells, but the connections between cells get rebuilt all the time. So at some part in your, sometime in your life, you might have a neuron that's communicating with one other neuron. But when you start to exercise that pathway, when you start to learn something, guess what happens? Now you got thousands of different pathways from maybe those two neurons going to various different places. So even though the numbers of cells in your brain doesn't change, the overall architecture changes dramatically when you exercise your brain, and that's a part of learning. And as a matter of fact, you might realize, even in a class like this, it's a lot easier to learn anatomy at the end of the class than during the first week, because it's just not study techniques, but the actual structure of your brain has changed dramatically, and it's just allowing you to learn anatomy much more efficiently. Right, so during the first week, maybe if you looked at those slides that had a transverse plane, coronal plane, sagittal plane, you maybe had to look at that simple diagram 10 or 20 times to make sure that you got the planes correctly. All right, at the end of the class, you could look at a diagram like that just one time and you'd be familiar with it. So you're probably going to notice that as you move through the class. Okay, so your brain is doing what? It's remodeling itself. It's rebuilding itself whenever you take a stimulating class or a hard class like anatomy or maybe a language class or a music class where you got to learn all kinds of new things. Your brain is actually changing its structure. And the cells that remodel the brain are most involved in that are astrocytes, because they secrete factors which cause different neurons to connect up with each other. And that process just can't happen overnight. So again, don't cram for a test, because you're not giving these astrocytes a chance to work. Okay, give them a couple days to work to make some new connections. All right, another kind of cell looks a little similar. We call this the microglia or microglial cell. These are cells that fight infection in the brain. These are like immune cells, and you have in your blood a lot of immune cells. Does anybody know the kinds of cells in your blood that are immune cells? Generally speaking, you have two kinds of cells in blood. You've got red blood cells that carry oxygen, and you got white blood cells. And it's those white blood cells that help fight infection. All right, so these microglia cells are more like the white blood cells in your blood than the red blood cells. They help fight infection. They help fight tumors that start to generate in your body, okay, brain tumors and things like that. And hopefully, if you ever get a brain tumor, these microglia cells destroy that tumor before you even know you've had a tumor. And probably we've all had funny things growing in our brain that these microglia got rid of before they caused a problem for us. All right, so immune response is what you want to say for microglia. And the next kind of cell, ependymal cell. You can see this ependymal cell is forming a layer. So what kind of tissue normally covers something or forms a layer? Epithelium. So these ependymal cells sort of look like epithelial cells, and that's how you can see it in the name, right? Ependymal right here, epithelium. But they're actually nervous system cells. They're not epithelium. And they line cavities that are inside the brain. We're going to learn some big cavities that are deep inside our brain. And there's a separation between the cavity that has a fluid in it and the nervous tissue that's underneath it, or the neurons underneath it. Anybody know what these big cavities are called inside our brain? They're called the ventricles, and we're going to learn a couple of ventricles, like four ventricles and different passageways in the brain. And so this just, again, helps protect the neurons from what's ever floating around inside this fluid right here. Does anybody know the name of this fluid? We're going to call that cerebrospinal fluid. And as a matter of fact, these ependymal cells in certain places of the brain actually synthesize and secrete that fluid into the ventricles. So that's another function of the ependymal cells. They help form that tissue that secretes cerebrospinal fluid, and that tissue, that specialized tissue in a couple parts of the ventricles, are what we call the choroid plexus. So ependymal cells, when they are highly vascularized with capillaries, form the choroid plexus. So again, what does the choroid plexus do for us? The choroid plexus that's made up of these ependymal cells. Anybody recall? It makes cerebrospinal fluid, or CSF. All right, so these ependymal cells actually make the fluid that fills these cavities up. Okay? All right, so that's another important function. And these chambers and the fluid in the ventricles help give shape to our brain, helps absorb shock, it protects our brain. So the fluid is very important. Now, the last kind of cell that we have. So where in the nervous system are we looking right now? Of the two main structural places, what are the two main structural divisions of our nervous system? You got central nervous system versus peripheral. So all of these cells, where are all these cells found? In the central nervous system. Yeah, so don't forget that. These are in the central nervous system. And so this last kind is what we call an oligodendrocyte. And you can see that it's wrapping itself around an axon. We've seen this before when we looked at a Schwann cell. So oligodendrocytes perform the same kind of function in the central nervous system as a Schwann cell. They are doing what to this axon? They're insulating the axon. So electrical signals can't leave this axon. But this oligodendrocyte, you can see, puts what we call, so the chemical that is produced, the insulating chemical, is called myelin. And so this coat of myelin around an axon is sometimes what we call a myelin sheath. An oligodendrocyte can put a myelin sheath around what? Multiple axons. All right, so here we have a process and another process going to different axons. So oligodendrocytes can myelinate many axons in the central nervous system with just one cell. And that's the big difference between an oligodendrocyte and a Schwann cell. All right, so I think we're done with central nervous system. And let's look at peripheral nervous system. I only got two kinds of cells in the peripheral nervous system that are neuroglia cells. Here we have, so let's look at the cell that's in yellow right here. What kind of neuron is that? That's a unipolar, right? Because there's that short unipolar process that bifurcates. So this is a nice sensory or afferent neuron. And then here are the cells that form the myelin sheath around this neuron. Now this is in the peripheral nervous system. These are all Schwann cells, individual Schwann cells. So that's one kind that are forming this myelin sheath. And the second kind are other cells that are surrounding the cell body in the dorsal root ganglia. These are what we call satellite cells. And so way back when, people that were studying anatomy were the same people that were building telescopes and looking up at the stars and the moon. They were just had a lot of extra time on their hands, I guess. Okay. And so when they saw underneath a microscope this nice dark nucleus from this unipolar neuron with a bunch of other spots surrounding it, it kind of looked like a planet with a bunch of moons around it. And so they call those satellite cells. So they're just cells, what, surrounding the main cell body. We might have a picture of what it actually looks like. And it looks remarkably like a planet in our solar system with moons circling around it. Okay, let me just look at the next slide real quick. All right, so here we have the cells that make a myelin sheath in the peripheral nervous system, which is a Schwann cell, versus the central nervous system, which is an oligodendrocyte. Okay, and this is how a Schwann cell works. All right, so it completely engulfs an axon, and then it just wraps more and more layers of the cell around the axon. And in these inner layers right here, they're filled completely with myelin, which is a lipid. Yeah?
The satellite cells, is that surrounding just the unicellular
Yeah, it's just around the cell body. You don't really... You know, you might find them around multipolar neurons as well. But I don't really know for sure. Okay? So I would say for sure the unipolar neurons. And if you are looking inside the central nervous system and you see a multipolar a multipolar neuron with a bunch of cells surrounding it, those are probably astrocytes and microglia and things like that. So I wouldn't really say satellite cells. Okay. So I would probably say, unipolar neuron. So if we cut this Schwann cell open, we can see all the different layers of myelin right here that is insulating the axon. And then the very outermost layer of a Schwann cell right here contains the cytoplasm of that cell, including the nucleus. Right, and the cytoplasm has salt and other kinds of proteins in it, so it is conductive of electricity to some degree. And this outer part of the Schwann cell, these outer layers that have cytoplasm in it, that's what we call the neurolemma. Right, so the neurolemma is this outer part that contains the nucleus and the rest of the cytoplasm, because this Schwann cell is very much alive. It's a living cell. Okay, I don't think I'm going to talk about that one. Let me go back to this slide right here. All right, so now I want to tell you another important feature of the myelin sheath. Right? So it acts like insulation so that electrical signals stay within an axon. That's important. That's a nice analogy that you have with wires. But something else is transpiring right here. Notice that the Schwann cells don't form a continuous sheath down the axon, that there are gaps between the Schwann cells. And can you tell me what the name of these gaps are called? That is the node of Ranvier. So there are nodes between Schwann cells. There are nodes between oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system as well. So here's a node of Ranvier. And the beautiful thing about having a myelinated neuron is that it can conduct electrical impulses very quickly compared to a neuron that doesn't have a myelin sheath. So impulse conduction is hundreds of times faster if it's myelinated. If it's a non-myelinated neuron, it's what? Hundreds of times slower. So when you have a myelinated axon, the electrical signal doesn't have to go from one molecule to the next molecule to the next 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 all the way down the axon. That electrical signal can actually hop from one node to the next, right? Skipping what? Millions of molecules in the process. So the speed of electrical transmission down a myelinated fiber is about 300 times faster than a non-myelinated. So the way that we talk about conduction of electrical impulses, if it is a myelinated fiber, we call it saltatory. Saltatory means what? It is hopping. That's what it means. It means jumping. And if it's a non-myelinated fiber, that means that the nerve impulse has to be transmitted continuously from one molecule to the next. We call that continuous conduction, and that's relatively slow. So one way maybe that you could help yourself remember what that is, think of maybe you're going to run down a flight of stairs, like these stairs right here. So if you had to run down the stairs in a hurry, what would be the faster way of doing it? Running down and stepping on every stair as you're running down the stairs, or maybe hopping every third or fourth stair? Hopping would be a lot faster. As a matter of fact, we could try this right now. Do we have a couple volunteers? Somebody want to hop down every fourth stair? Somebody want to step on every single stair? No, because you might crash. All right, but let's just say you could do that, right? Just use a little thought experiment, and you could just tell what? That if you skipped a bunch of stairs, you'd be a lot faster. Okay. Well, I wouldn't volunteer for that either. Okay, so myelin sheaths cover axons. They provide insulation and increase what? Speed of nerve impulse conduction. We call that saltatory conduction. And that saltatory conduction just hops from one node to the next. Continuous conduction from non-myelinated fibers is relatively slow. Okay. So that's how things get transmitted within an axon. Now let's go back and look at that synapse again. Okay, we were looking at a synapse earlier. Okay, so I'm going to come back to that. Where's the synapse at? I must have passed it already. Ah, here it is. Okay. All right, so down an axon. So, oh, what kind of neuron is this right here by structure? That's a multipolar. So it's going to be an efferent neuron, for instance, or an association neuron. Here's another multipolar neuron right here. And here is a space between these two neurons. What is, yeah, that's the synapse. So what do we call this first neuron? That's the presynaptic neuron. And what's the second one? This distal neuron right here is the postsynaptic neuron, right? And what, and the thing between them is the synapse, right? And so the way information is passed in the presynaptic neuron, it's an electrical signal. It gets converted to a chemical signal within the synapse, and then it gets reconverted into an electrical signal in the postsynaptic neuron. So let's zoom in to the synapse right here, and we can see the presynaptic neuron with a little swelling at the end of the axon terminus. So sometimes we would call this a synaptic terminal or a Bouton terminale. What else did we call this? Somebody else actually came up with another name that I had heard of. Terminal button, terminal Bouton, a whole bunch of different names, but it's a little swelling at the end of an axon, and you can see them right here in miniature. So what do we got in there? Factory making ATP, right? And then we got vesicles, hundreds of vesicles filled with a chemical signaling compound. And so we call these synaptic vesicles. They're going to bind to places, special places on the presynaptic membrane that we call just presynaptic densities. They have the right proteins that allow for docking of these vesicles. All right, so when an impulse comes down an axon and flows over, an electrical signal flows over this synapse right here, then that's going to allow calcium to enter the terminal button, and that calcium is going to signal the docking and fusing of these synaptic vesicles to the presynaptic membrane. And when that happens, that's going to cause release of neurotransmitter, or this signaling molecule, into the space between the cells, which is what we call the synaptic cleft. Okay, so what's the chemical signal that causes the fusion of these vesicles to the presynaptic membrane? What's a signal that started outside the cell and it entered the cell? All right, the electrical signal causes what to enter the cell in the synapse, right? Calcium. Okay, so it's a calcium ion that causes the docking and the fusion of these vesicles. And the release of this neurotransmitter, what's a general name of that process called? You could probably call it a couple different things. You could call it secretion, okay? But secretion is an active transport process. So what do you call that process when something's inside a vesicle and it gets released outside the cell? We call that exocytosis, right? So these are all active processes that require energy. Where does that energy come from? This mitochondria right here. Okay, so that's an important component of this terminal button. All right, so now you've got neurotransmitter in the synaptic cleft. It's going to move across the synapse and bind to receptor molecules in the postsynaptic membrane. And when the neurotransmitter binds to the receptor molecule, it's going to start another electrical signal on the postsynaptic cell. So you've got electrical signal, chemical signal, electrical signal moving across the synapse. And this is just a nice general way that cells can communicate with each other. So synapse is what we call the structural and functional unit of communication between two cells. And we're probably going to learn a number of different kinds of neurotransmitters, but does anybody know a name of a specific neurotransmitter? Maybe I mentioned this last time. Acetylcholine or acetylcholine is a name of a neurotransmitter. And it is used at the neuromuscular junction. That's the synapse between a motor neuron and a skeletal muscle cell. It's also used in other places in the nervous system that we're going to look at in the next in two chapters coming up. Okay, so the synapse is an important model for you to have in your mind. All right, so the synapse is, synaptic knob. I forgot to mention that. The synaptic knob is what? The Bouton terminale. It's a little swelling at the axon terminus. All right, so the synaptic knob is a bulge at the axon terminus of the what neuron? The presynaptic neuron. Contains mitochondria, endoplasmic reticulum, vesicles filled with neurotransmitter. All right, and in the in one name of a common one is acetylcholine. Another component. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they're all gonna have that general same form. Okay? And even the neuromuscular junction is gonna have the same kind of form. It's gonna have the neuron, which is the presynaptic cell. But in the neuromuscular junction, what's the postsynaptic cell? It's the muscle cell. Okay, so it's a muscle cell that gets excited. And once a muscle cell gets excited, what's it gonna do? It's gonna move around. Okay? So if you have two neurons and the presynaptic cell is exciting the postsynaptic neuron, it doesn't cause the neurons to move around at all. But if it's a neuromuscular junction and the motor neuron causes the muscle cell to contract and move around, then the communication can be lost. So the big difference between a neuron-neuron synapse and a neuromuscular junction is that they're extra little proteins that connect the neuron to the muscle so that when the muscle moves around, guess what goes with it? The neuron moves with it. Because the neuron can only stimulate the muscle at that one particular microscopic location. So if the neuron gets displaced from that neuromuscular junction, it can't communicate with the muscle anymore. So the neuromuscular junction has got a few more components so that the neuron and the muscle are glued together or stabilized, even though the muscle can move. There's receptor molecules underneath the axon terminus on the muscle, just like if it was a postsynaptic neuron. Yeah. So neuromuscular junction just has more bridges between them to anchor the neuron and the muscle together, because of course the muscle is what? Going to move around when it gets excited. Nerves don't really do that. Okay. Okay, so the postsynaptic membrane has receptors on it that have channels for sodium. We didn't have to look at a lot of chemical compounds in this particular class, but Na stands for sodium. That's on a periodic table over here. That's one component in salt that we eat. Table salt is just sodium chloride. But look at this sodium right here. Okay, Na stands for sodium. But what else is on this sodium? It's a plus sign. Okay? Yeah. That means that it has an electrical charge on it. So even though your body doesn't use electricity like we use in wires in the wall right here, your body still has a lot of compounds that we call ions that have a positive charge or negative charges. And when sodium moves through your body, since it's a charged particle, that's really what? It's an electrical current, okay, because that plus sign right there means it has an electrical charge, and as that molecule moves through your body, it produces an electrical current as a result of that. So the postsynaptic membrane will allow sodium to move through it at certain times that produces an electrical current in the postsynaptic cell. Okay. So here I think is just a little description of what I've talked about already about synaptic transmission. Right, so we look at the structure of the synapse, but how it functions is what we call synaptic transmission. So the first thing that happens is that the synaptic knob depolarizes. That means that the electrical signal arrives at the axon terminus. And that causes release of neurotransmitter because depolarization of the synaptic knob causes the opening of calcium channels. And look at, what else can you tell me about this calcium right here? It has a positive charge too. As a matter of twice as many as the sodium does. So calcium, when it moves, produces an electrical current as well. Okay, but this calcium acts as a signal, which then causes the fusion of these vesicles to the membrane. All right, and then the neurotransmitter is released into the synaptic cleft. All right, and then the neurotransmitter binds to receptors on the postsynaptic membrane that opens up sodium channels. It causes a current in the postsynaptic cell. And then finally, the neurotransmitter is degraded in the synaptic cleft so that it doesn't keep stimulating the postsynaptic cell forever and ever and ever, which is really a good thing. Because once you contract the muscle, what would you like to happen?
Go back.
Yeah, to relax, or if you want it to stay contracted, you have to keep giving it signals to stay contracted. But you don't want a muscle to stay contracted forever. Okay. All right, so can information ever be passed from the postsynaptic neuron back to the presynaptic neuron through the synapse? Another fancy term for going backwards is retrograde. Can information ever be passed retrograde from the postsynaptic neuron back to the presynaptic neuron? Why is that? Let's look at the diagram right here. So that would be information over here in this neuron going back into the presynaptic neuron. Well, a good way to realize that is that in the postsynaptic neuron, there are no synaptic vesicles. There is no neurotransmitter that can flow back across the synapse. You only have neurotransmitter in which neuron? The presynaptic neuron. Furthermore, in this density right here, we have receptors, and receptors are only found in the postsynaptic membrane, not the presynaptic membrane. So even if the postsynaptic neuron could release neurotransmitter, there's nothing in the presynaptic membrane that could sense it, that could do anything with that information. So information always flows in this one-way direction through the synapse. All right, so how is information transmitted within a neuron? As opposed to how is information transmitted between neurons? Okay, so within a neuron, it is an electrical signal, and between neurons it is a chemical signal. All right, and we know enough to answer the second question a little bit more completely. For instance, that chemical signal, what do we call that chemical signal? That's what we call a neurotransmitter. And what's a specific name of one of your favorite neurotransmitters? Acetylcholine. And there's others out there like serotonin, epinephrine, dopamine. Okay, and I think next time we're going to actually learn a little bit more about that electrical signal within a neuron. All right, so we're going to talk about actually depolarization and repolarization a little bit next time after we do a little review. So make sure you can identify your motor neurons from your sensory neurons, from your special sensory neurons like both bipolar, and know the functions of all the neuroglia too, and be able to identify by their shape. Okay. So that's it for today. Bye.